Watchman's Teaching Letter, Volume 3, Norse Legends. Watchman's Teaching Letter Number 44, December 2001, from the 2001 Watchman's Teaching Letters by Clifton Emmeheiser, read by Dan Adams. This is my 44th monthly teaching letter and continues my fourth year of publication. In the last several lessons, we have been on the subject of Egypt. In lesson number 42, we got on the subject of the Ashet tree, which is inscribed several times on Egyptian obelisks. After writing that lesson, I have found much more information concerning the ash tree. Then, I wrote about the ash tree again in lesson number 43. This has led to an extended research into Norse mythology. Norse legend would be a better designation, for there is little myth about Norse mythology. Since writing lesson number 43, an avalanche of information has come my way on that subject too. There is much material to present on this. I hardly know where to start. For the moment, it is imperative we drop the subject of Egypt to cover in some degree the beliefs of the Norse. Evidence is coming forth that the so-called gods of the Norse, like Odin, Balder, and Freya, are actually real people and not myth. Also, for those who are interested in Odinism, I would warn you, there are twisted half-truths and downright lies on the internet concerning him. After we have covered this interrelated subject, we will get back to walking step by step through Israel's sojourn in Egypt from Joseph until Joshua. The best place I know to start this is with the Encyclopedia Britannica, 9th edition, 1894, Volume 2, page 594, under the topic Asgard. The historical explanation of Asgard, as given by the early northern authorities, is that in the country called Asaheim, in the east of Tanagvise, the Tanais, or Dawn, in Asia, there was a city, Asgard, in which ruled a great chief known as Odin, or Wodin, who presided over religious sacrifices which were held there. At that time, the Roman generals were marching over the world and reducing nations to subjection, and Odin, foreknowing that he and his posterity would occupy the northern lands, and unwilling to encounter the Romans, left Asaheim with a vast multitude of followers and wandered first westward to Gardarike, Russia, and afterwards to Saxland, north and east Germany. After some time he proceeded northward till at length he came to the Mahler Lake in Sweden, where they settled at a place known as Sigtuna, the present Uppsala. His 12 diar, or chief priests, in the course of time, founded states for themselves, and everywhere set up the laws and usages which they had followed in Asaheim. Here we have an historical link with the mythic story of Odin's halls in Asgard and his 12 attendants, Aesir, but we have no means of fixing the date of the events referred to. It has been conjectured that Odin may have lived at the time when Mithraides Upator was defying the armies of Rome, 120 to 80 BC, and that to avoid subjection to either power, he and other Sarmatians, or Caucasian chiefs, left their settlement on the Black Sea and wandered forth in search of new and independent homes to the north and west, to the primary Asiatic seat of their tribes. It is not improbable that traditionary records of such earlier migrations had lingered among the people dwelling on the shores of the Euxine, the Black Sea, for it is certain that, whatever may be the age of Odin's appearance in Scandinavia, previous waves of population had passed from the Black Sea to the Baltic and cleared the way for the reception of that highest phase of Aryan civilization brought to northern Europe by Odin and his followers. End quote. We can see from this that Odin is not a myth, but a real historical person. What we have just read from this quotation from the Encyclopedia Britannica is of the utmost importance. This documentation on Odin makes a direct link between 2 Esdras 13:39-45 about the lost Israelites in the Apocrypha and the Anglo-Saxons, as there is also a complete biblical historical link between the Zerah branch of Judah in Egypt and the Britons. There is one problem with this quotation, for it speaks of the Sarmatians as though they were part of Odin's group, when actually the Sarmatians were an entirely different people. In his book Missing Links Discovered in Assyrian Tablets, E. Raymond Capt deals with the subjects of Odin and the Sarmatians. While Capt gives many references, he usually doesn't quote directly from them. If he had quoted the passage which I just used from the Encyclopedia Britannica, it would have had a great impact on his readers. Capt seems to take the posture, "Here are the facts, trust me." Notwithstanding, though, Capt did a phenomenal job. Capt says this on pages 175 and 176. A new empire had been established in the northern half of Sweden, founded by the historical Odin. The account of Odin, as narrated by Snorri in the Ynglinga saga, states that Odin came from Asaland, or Asaheim, central Scythia. Odin assembled at Asgard, modern Kiev, once the capital of Asaland, a huge army which marched up the valley of the Dnieper, then westward to the shore of the Baltic, Pelagius Scythicum, and finally to Scandinavia. It was from Odin's army, known as the Svear, that Sweden takes its name. In their own language, the Swedes call their country Sverige, the land of the Svear. The date of Odin is given variously as between 200 and 300 AD. In the Heralds College, London, there is a very ancient manuscript deducing the Saxon kings from Adam and from David. Odin is listed in the genealogy, as is also his wife Freya, tracing the royal house of Britain back to David. End quote. Cap then produces a chart from David to King George V and Queen Mary, which includes Anna, the cousin of the Virgin Mary, Penardim, marrying Leah of Judah through Troy, Bran, Carodoc, Coelus, Lucius, Cadwallader, to Freya on one side, then showing Odin descended through Troy from Judah, marrying Freya. From these two came the Tudors, Stuarts, Plantagenets, Hanoverians, Saxe-Coburgs, Danes, to King George V and Queen Mary. Continuing the quote from Capt, Odin introduced among the people a new religion, the tenets of which faith included the fatherhood of God, the immortality of the soul, future rewards and punishments, the consecration of valor, seeking ever to die in battle rather than peace, this being the ultimate goal by which they might attain to Valhalla, the Hall of Heroes, or Heaven. After the death of Odin, his authority was transmitted to his 5 sons, whom he had placed on neighboring thrones. In time, Odin came to be regarded by the early Scandinavians as a mythical god. From Odin's son, Skiold, descended the Skioldums, a race of kings, which long held the scepter of Denmark. Ynge, another son, reigned in Sweden, and from him sprang the Ynglings, a name by which the ancient sovereigns of that country were distinguished in history. Yet another son, Balder, became viceroy over the Angles, and from him the Anglo-Saxon princes all traced their origin. Horsa and Hengist, the 2 Saxon chiefs who fought the English, that's the British, in the 5th century, reckon Odin, or Wodin in their dialect, as their ancestor. End quote. Now that we have substantial evidence that Odin was more than a mythological character, being in fact a historical living person, let's now consider a false assumption that was made concerning him. It is found in the book The Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop. While this book has a lot of valuable information, and I am not about to throw my copy in the trash, some of its contents demand scrutiny, the subject of Odin being one of them. However, putting aside this erroneous conclusion, it is apparent that Hyslop was a diligent researcher and acquainted with Norse mythology. Let's pick up his observations about Odin on pages 57 and 58. In Iceland and throughout Scandinavia, there were similar lamentations for the loss of the god Baldr. Baldr, through the treachery of the god Loki, the spirit of evil, according as had been written in the Book of Destiny, was slain, although the Empire of Heaven depended on his life. His father Odin had learned the terrible secret from the Book of Destiny, having conjured one of the Volar from her infernal abode. All the gods trembled at the knowledge of this event. Then Frigga, the wife of Odin, called on every object, animate and inanimate, to take an oath not to destroy or furnish arms against Baldr. Fire, water, rocks, and vegetables were bound by this solemn obligation. One plant only, the mistletoe, was overlooked. Loki discovered the omission and made that contemptible shrub the fatal weapon. Among the warlike pastimes of Valhalla, the assembly of the gods, one was to throw darts at the invulnerable deity who felt a pleasure in presenting his charred breast to their weapons. At a tournament of this kind, the evil genius, putting a sprig of mistletoe into the hands of the blind Hodur and directing his aim, the dreaded prediction was accomplished by an unintentional fratricide. The spectators were struck with speechless wonder, and their misfortune was the greater, that no one, out of respect to the sacredness of the place, dared to avenge it. With tears of lamentation they carried the lifeless body to the shore and laid it upon a ship, as a funeral pile, no, that's a pyre, with that of Nanna, his lovely bride, who had died of a broken heart. His horse and arms were burnt at the same time, as was customary at the obsequies of the ancient heroes of the North. End quote. On pages 133 and 134, Hyslop goes amiss with his reasoning. Let's take a look at it. From the researches of Humboldt, we find that the Mexicans celebrated Woden as the founder of their race, just as our own ancestors did. The Wodan or Odin of Scandinavia can be proved to be the Adon of Babylon. The Wodan of Mexico, from the following quotation, will be seen to be the very same. According to the ancient traditions collected by the Bishop Francis Nunez de la Vega, says Humboldt, the Wodan of the Chiapanese of Mexico was grandson of that illustrious old man who at the time of the great deluge in which the greater part of the human race perished was saved on a raft together with his family. Wodan cooperated in the construction of the great edifice which had been undertaken by men to reach the skies. The execution of this rash project was interrupted. Each family received from that time a different language. End quote. Then in the appendix, on page 312, Hyslop says, Now Baal and Adon both alike signify Lord, and therefore if Baldr be admitted to be the seed or son of Baal, that is as much as to say that he is the son of Adon, and consequently Adon and Odin must be the same. End quote. Here the question must be asked, how did the living historical Odin of 200 A.D., excluding other Odins, go to Mexico shortly after Noah's flood? Come on, people. Clifton has always asked you to use a little common sense, which is how he tied the archaeological findings at Jericho with the 18th dynasty in Egypt. We have long had quite enough of people with deplorable conclusions reached due to some cool-sounding idea that researchers want to be true, but which results in a stretch that ultimately backfires, though it may take a long time. The only way for Norse mythology to have gotten to Mexico would be if the Vikings took it there, or possibly the Catholic priests, accompanying the Spanish with Cortez. It is my opinion that the name Odin has absolutely nothing to do with Baal. Can you now see why, just because it might be on the written page, it is not necessarily so? Now that we have covered the fact that Odin was a true historic person, let's go back to the article I quoted from the Encyclopedia Britannica about Odin, under the title Asgard. As this article mentioned the Sarmatians, thus we really need to understand they were a non-Israelite tribe. For this I will again quote from E. Raymond Capps' Missing Links Discovered in Assyrian Tablets. From page 141, all historical accounts agree that the Cimmerians or Cimmerians were in the southern areas west of the Black Sea before the Scythians. It was the Scythians, pushed by the Sarmatians, that caused the Cimmerians to move westward as Celts and Gauls. End quote. From pages 167 through 169. The Sarmatians were first mentioned by ancient historians in the 5th century BC under the name Sauromatae. Herodotus says their land lay 3 days' journey east of the Don River and 3 days' journey northwards from the Sea of Azov, northeast and behind Crimea. Archaeological research has shown they extended over the wide grassland of the Eurasiatic border east of the Don River, nearly up to the Ural River, and northwards along the Volga up to the Saratov. They were of mixed Iranian stock, combining features of various late Bronze Age cultures, particularly of the Maeotians, and later some Greek and Scythian people, with whom they were in close contact. Herodotus mentions that the Sarmatians used the Scythian language, speaking it corruptly. The Sarmatians had no permanent settlements. They lived for the most part on horses, and their dwellings were wagons drawn by oxen. In dress, culture, and customs, they were similar to the Scythians. They wore trousers and pointed caps. Their wives retained the ancient Amazon mode of living, joining their husbands in the hunt and in war, and wearing the same dress as the men. No virgin was permitted to marry until she had killed an enemy. End quote. From what we are compiling, we can begin to see these lost Israelite tribes making their way into Europe had both Rome, with her armies, and a continued ongoing friction with the Mithraeadites' kings to avoid, along with the Sarmatians, to their backs. When we consider this, it is no wonder they made Odin their hero in legend after getting them safely through that predicament. It isn't all that much different from our day when we make hero idols of men like General Douglas MacArthur and General George Patton. In the so-called Norse mythology, they love their war heroes so much, and not wanting their children to forget them, they assign their names to the days of the week. Wednesday is Odin's day. Thursday is Thor's day. Friday is Freya's day. All real people. It's no different than naming city streets after our presidents. Look at the legend we have made out of David, Davy Crockett. Encyclopedia Britannica, 1894, Volume 1, says this about Tuesday. His name, Azir, which signifies honor, is found in the names of the days of the week in Old Norse, Danish, Anglo-Saxon, and in our own Tuesday, that shows that like Thor or Frey or Freya, whose memory is perpetuated in our Thursday and Friday, the worship of this bravest of the Aesir was widely spread among the peoples of northern origin. End quote. If this is true, it's about time that we teach our children that these days of the week are named after our great Israelite heroes, so they too can be proud of them. Why don't we start calling them Odin's Day, Thor's Day, and Freya's Day? It would sure make a good conversation piece, and I am certain it would get someone's attention. To further our knowledge of these Norse terms and how they fit into our study of the Bible, I will now quote from a book, The Heritage of the Anglo-Saxon Race, by M. H. Geyer, OBE. Well, this is a tremendous book. Like most of the information coming from British Israel, the author identifies the Germans as Assyrians, when actually the true Germans are of the Pharez branch of Judah. Also, the author makes the claim that some of the Japanese are descended from Israelites. I rather believe that some of the Japanese are descended from the Ammonites, the children by Lot's incest with his daughters. Otherwise, the information from this source is excellent. It should also be mentioned there is a beautiful color chart by the same name that goes along with this book. We are interested in pages 46 through 53. Some references to the chart will be omitted. Zara and Pharez, twin sons of Judah. At the birth of these twins, the midwife tied a scarlet thread round the wrist of Zara to distinguish him as the firstborn. Genesis 38:27-30. The birthright passed, however, to Pharez, from whom later sprang the house of David. Nothing is recorded in the Bible of the early life of these boys. Their names are simply mentioned as amongst the 70 souls who accompanied Jacob on his journey into Egypt. Genesis 46:12. It is probable, however, that jealous rivalry would exist between them in connection with the birthright, which each lad would naturally covet. Be that as it may, it is certain that it was descendants of Pharez who entered into Palestine with Israel, and that it was this branch, with the part of the descendants of Shelah, Judah's third son, formed the tribe of Judah in the Promised Land. Zara appears to have broken away from his people while the Israel nation was still in its infancy down in Egypt, and like his cousins, the pioneers of Dan set out in search of adventure along the southern lands of Europe. Though deprived of the actual birthright, Zara nevertheless still comprised one-third of the tribe of Judah, with an equal right to all that had been promised to the sons of Jacob, though he settled in a foreign land. Zara. The four genealogical lines originating in Zara are reproduced, by kind permission, from the chart entitled The Illustrious Lineage of the Royal House of Britain, by the Reverend W. M. H. Milner, M.A., F.R.G.S., a wonderful work which, together with his book The Royal House of Britain, every Anglo-Israel student should possess. From chapter 41 onwards, the book of Isaiah is written to that section of Israel called Israel in the Isles. While the bulk of Israel migrated or was carried captive eastward to Assyria, and during some 17 subsequent centuries was slowly struggling across Europe to its final home in the West, involved in all the great military movements of the ages, the Israel branch which settled in the Isles and constituted the Western migration played a very important part. In the earliest stage of this Western migration, the descendants of Zara, Judah, and Dan were the principal actors. It is also certain, however, that the other tribes of their old homeland were also amply represented by colonists who emigrated during the troublous years preceding the captivity. Zara had five sons, two of whom, Darda and Kalkal, are important in history. Darda, mentioned in 1 Chronicles 2:6 and 1 Kings 4:31, also by Josephus the historian as Dardanus, is believed to have been the Dardanus who founded Ilion, or Troy, while Kalkal, or Kecrops, founded Athens in Greece, circa 1556 BC. These emigrants of Zara's branch, continuing to spread further along southern Europe, also started large colonies in Spain, the Iberian or Hebrew Peninsula. Here their capital was named Zaragoza, today Saragossa, in memory of their ancestor, Zara. A glance at the migration map reveals a number of familiar names in ancient Spain, derived from the Hebrew root, that is, the rivers Ebro, Ebrus, Ebur, Britannium, Iberia, Celtiberia, etc. From these people in Spain are traced the Clan Mili, or Scots Gauls, who, according to the latest manuscript, came into Britain about 1000 BC, and from this section of Judah are descended the old Scottish kings of Ireland and our present royal house. In the book accompanying his chart, Mr. Milner gives much interesting information connected with these genealogies originating in Zara. Pedigree 1. This pedigree, tracing through the house of Troy, Priam, Hector, etc., passes down through the Sicambrian kings to the Franks, then to the French, where Hildegard, daughter of Charlemagne, married Eberhard, lord of Beutelsbach. From here, 31 generations bring us to Francis, Duke of Teck, who, marrying Princess Mary of Cambridge, became the father of Her Majesty, our beloved Queen Mary, and so on to Prince David, her son. Pedigree 2. Again starts through Priam, king of Troy, whose daughter, it is said, married Memnon the Greek. The son Tror, whom we call Thor, was father of Hiorita, ancestor of Odin. Odin led our forefathers across Europe from Asgard to the shores of the Baltic. His victorious march traversed Russia, Germany, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden. To him a crown was given by the great overruler of all things, which he multiplied, crowning his sons kings of the countries he conquered, thereby securing his own position as the royal ancestor of all the dynasties of Europe. They converge, as by one consent, in the royal house of Britain. Without a single link wanting, we can trace our king and queen back to the five of Odin's sons. Royal House of Britain, page 27. The date of Odin is given variously as between 200 and 300 A.D. In the Heralds' College, London, there is a very ancient and valuable manuscript deducing our Saxon kings from Adam and from David. Odin is there, so also is his wife Freya, who figures apparently as the daughter of Cadwallader, son of our British king Lucius. It is a fact recorded by several early church historians that Lucius left his kingly throne in Britain and became the evangelist of Switzerland and Bavaria. Freya might well then have been his granddaughter, settled in Central Europe at the epoch of Odin's historic march into the West, circa 250 AD. From their marriage, the following genealogy results. Odin, descended through Troy from Judah, married Freya, descended from Lucius, again through Anna, therefore producing the Tudors, Stuarts, Plantagenets, Hanoverians, Saxe-Coburgs, and Danes. King George V married Queen Mary, Edward VIII abdicated, and George VI. Pedigree 3. The tale of Troy brings Judah into touch with every period of our royal history. This pedigree, again opening with Zara, Mahal, Darda, brings the line through early British kings to Aeneas and his grandson Brutus. There seems no reason to doubt the traditional story that Brutus, having accidentally killed his father in the chase, and being ordered by his grandfather Aeneas to quit Italy, assembled 3,000 of the bravest youths of Umbria, and putting himself at their head, sailed to his countrymen in Greece. From here, after various adventures, Brutus emigrated with all his people to the main stock of his race, the White Island, Britain. 12 miles inland from Torbay in South Devon, at Totnes, on the Dart, there can be seen a granite boulder embedded in the pavement of Fore Street, and over this relic a sign inscribed, "This is Brutus' Stone." the tradition being that on this stone the Trojan prince set foot when he landed in Britain some years after the fall of Troy. Prehistoric London, E. O. Gordon. Many old historians state that this Brutus was the founder of London, to which city he gave the name Caer Troia, Troy Novant, or New Troy, circa 1100 BC. This name, however, never became popular with the people, who preferred the old name of Yondon or London, meaning sacred eminence, prehistoric London. What is more especially interesting to our race, however, is that it was just at the time when Brutus was founding our great city London that the promise was given by God to King David in Palestine. Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel and will plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own and move no more, neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them any more, as before time. 2 Samuel 7:10. Date of Brutus, 1100 BC. Date of David, 1056 BC. According to the Pantlilid manuscript of Yunslore, this pedigree, continuing, carries us down to King Lear, who married Penardim, daughter of Anna of the house of David, thence later to Freya, who married Odin, and also, through another son, carries the line on to the Tudors. Penardim also appears as a male name, missing links by Capt, page 176. The Tudor ancestors of our present royal family are, by two lines, descended from the Davidic princess Anna, who, according to very ancient Welsh manuscripts, was cousin to the Virgin Mary. B. M. Harrell, manuscript of 3859 from 1936. Anna was apparently the daughter of Joseph of Arimathea, the rich ruler who buried the body of Christ, who by Eastern tradition is said to have been the uncle of the Virgin Mary. This Joseph of Arimathea, with a band of fellow evangelists, brought the gospel to Britain within 5 years of our Lord's ascension, and was permitted by the courtesy of the British king Arviragus to establish his Avalon, Glastonbury, the first national Christian church of the world. See St. Paul in Britain, Morgan. Reckoning 30 years for a generation, the pedigree carries us back 1,080 years, that is 330 years before the foundation of Rome. St. Paul in Britain. Passing on further, we come down to the three blessed sovereigns of the Isle of Britain. Bran, the Blessed, who in AD 36 resigned the Silurian crown and became Archdruid of the College of Silurian, Southwest Wales. Caradoc, his son, whom every Briton, from the king to the peasant, followed when he lifted his spear to battle, first Christian in Britain. His three children, Silinus, who later became King Linus, who became first bishop of Rome, and Gladys, adopted and renamed Claudia by the Emperor Claudius in Rome. Claudia, in her 17th year, married Rufus Pudens, a Roman officer whom she had met in Britain. Their home in Rome became the headquarters of St. Paul in his visits to that city. Pudens, Linus, and Claudia are affectionately greeted by name in St. Paul's letter to Timothy, 2 Timothy 4:21. The four children of Pudens and Claudia were instructed in the faith by St. Paul himself, and together with their father and Linus were the first Britons to suffer martyrdom for the faith of Christ. They were all interred in the side of St. Paul in the Via Ostiensis. Lucius, king and missionary, grandson of Caelinus, changed the established religion of Britain from Druidism to Christianity. Cadwallader, the Blessed, his son, who gave protection within all his land to the Christians who fled from the pagan Saxons. Freya, daughter of Cadwallader, who, as we have seen, married Odin, St. Paul in Britain. This ancient Irish genealogy, unlike the others, is traced from Zara through Calcal, or Cecrops. From the latest manuscript, we learn that Clan Mili, or Scots Gauls, are traced into Britain from the Zara Judah colony in Spain, and from that time, about 1000 BC, continue their history in Ireland. In the Malaysian records, we find these people called Kurait Nakru Ruab, that is, the Knights of the Red Branch. Now, when we remember that all through their history the emblem of Northern Ireland, Ulster, has been the Red Hand, and then recall the story of the birth of the twins Zara and Fares, how a scarlet thread was tied round Zara's wrist to distinguish him. This fact is certainly remarkable, for it was from this branch of the Zara Judah family that Ochaid the Harriman descended, who in 580 BC married Tamar Tephi, daughter of Zedekiah, last king of Judah. To Judah, about 1700 BC was promised the scepter, till Shiloh come, that is, Christ, Genesis 49:10. To David, about 1050 BC was promised the throne of Israel forever, Jeremiah 33:17. By the union in 580 BC of Aokide, prince of Ireland, Zara Judah stock with Tamar Tephi of the royal house of David, Phares Judah stock, these two branches were welded into one royal house, which has now continued for 2500 years its rule over Israel, Britain, in unbroken succession, first in Ireland, then in Scotland, then in England, and must so continue till the return of Christ to take his throne. In connection with the sacred thread, it is interesting to note that scarlet has never lost its significance in Israel-British history. Rahab used a line of scarlet thread when helping the Israel spies to escape from Jericho, Joshua 2:18. The official British uniform is scarlet. See Farrar Fenton's translation of the Bible, Nahum 2:3. Writing of the armies of Israel and Judah, the shields of his heroes are red, his mighty commanders in scarlet. British official documents and parcels are tied with scarlet ribbon or tape, hence the term red tape. The British thin red line is famous the world over. Phares. Nothing of special interest is recorded of Phares, twin brother of Zara, beyond the fact that to him descended the tribal birthright, and that he was the ancestor of the royal house of David. The descendants of Phares and of Shelah, the third son of Judah, appear to have composed most of the tribe of Judah in Palestine, as Zara left his people while they were down in the land of Egypt. End quote. The main thrust of this last lengthy quotation is to show you the close connection between the so-called Norse mythology and the Bible. If you are not familiar with the story of Judah, this last segment should help you to grasp his part in the biblical scheme of things. In the next lesson, we will continue this topic in greater detail. Remember, we got on this subject when we discovered inscriptions on an Egyptian obelisk concerning an Ashet tree. Our goal for getting into all this is to learn more about true Odinism as opposed to false Odinism. End of Watchman's Teaching Letter number 44. Thank you for listening.